Welcome to the Bone Coach Show, dedicated to helping you understand all things related to diet, lifestyle, bone health, and how you can live and thrive with low bone density and osteoporosis. I'm your host, Kevin Ellis, certified health coach, health and wellness speaker, and above all else, your bone coach. After being diagnosed with osteoporosis in my early 30s, I transformed my health through diet and lifestyle and now help my clients and community members do the same through my online coaching practice, BoneCoach.com. Look, there are no quick and easy cures for low bone density, but the choices we make every single day can have a powerful impact on our bones, our health, and our general well-being. I'll share the research, interview the experts, and help you figure out how to get the conditions right in your body so you can better your bones through diet and lifestyle. A short disclaimer, I'm not a medical doctor, and this show should not be considered medical advice. Always consult with your healthcare team before making medical decisions and changes to your diet and lifestyle. With that being said, let's get on to the show. Want to know how heavy metals negatively impact your body, your bone health, and osteoporosis? Want to know the preferred method of testing for heavy metals? Want to know the two things you need to be doing before embarking on any detoxification protocol? And are you ready to learn the actionable steps you can be doing today to help maintain a detoxified body? If you want to learn those things, you're going to want to stick around to the end of this interview with Dr. Christine Schaffner. Before we get to the interview, I want to encourage you to do two things. The first one is right down below this video, there's a link to BoneCoach.com. I want you to pause this video, head over there, sign up for your free 7-day osteoporosis kickstart guide, and that's going to give you everything you need to start taking charge of your bone health right now. The second thing I want you to do is there is a red subscribe button. Just punch that subscribe button so you get notified every time I put out a new episode that will help you improve your bone health. With that being said, let's get on with the show. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Christine Schaffner, a board-certified naturopathic physician who graduated from Bestyr University in Seattle, Washington. She has undergraduate studies in pre-medicine and psychology and has studied in the United States, Germany, Switzerland, learning from top experts in the field of biological medicine, naturopathic medicine, functional medicine, integrative medicine, and you're always trying to incorporate the latest findings into your practice. Really, the people who are benefiting most from your knowledge and expertise are your patients who you see at the Sophia Health Institute in Woodlandville, Washington, and Marin Naturopathic Medicine in California, as well as Bella Fior Organic Med Spa and Clinic in Seattle. Christine has a fantastic podcast called the Spectrum of Health Podcast. She's been a host of the Heavy Metal Summit with Wendy Myers, Dr. Dieter Klinghart, and really it's a pleasure to have you today. So Dr. Schaffner, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for the introduction and for having me.
No, I'm glad you could be here. Well, one of the first things I wanted to ask was, how did you even get into the field of naturopathic medicine?
It's a great question. And, you know, we all have our journey, right? And so I grew up in a family of medicine. My father is an oncologist. My mom has a nursing background, but she has been a teacher in nursing schools as well as worked in a hospital setting as a director of quality and education. And so I grew up around medicine. And pretty early on, and I would say in my high school years, I started having a real affinity to look at mind, body, spirit medicine. You know, when bookstores were still around, I would find myself in the bookstore in the, you know, the spiritual development or the self-help, you know, section, just really curious. You know, fast forward, I went to University of Virginia. I, you know, really grappled with either becoming a medical doctor or a naturopathic doctor. And, you know, my winding journey led me to Bestyr University in Seattle. And it was just a timing thing. And I, when I landed there, I, you know, just was really super passionate about finding out really what are the root causes of why people are sick and looking at these whole other elements beyond our physical body. And when I graduated from Bestyr in 2010, I was able to just start working with my mentor, Dr. Dieter Klinghart, right away. And you know, he attracts patients from all over the country, all over the world. And he, being a medical doctor and a PhD, he really had this you know, lens of not only that framework, but really he was tasked to try to help people who had already seen, on average, you know, 20 to 30 doctors. And when I do these talks, I sometimes, to give you a perspective, I was one patient's 54th doctor, you know, so it's just, wow. These are people who tried a lot of things and, you know, so we have to stretch ourselves, right, and to constantly learn, you know, why people are sick and what are the root causes and, you know, where we stand right now and what we're going to get, you know, we'll dive into, of course, is there's a combination of things. Again, I see chronically ill people who are affected, you know, multiple systems are affected, many, you know, many symptoms, years of struggling. And, you know, it's this combination of looking at their terrain, right? So looking at the ecosystem in their body and how really this interplay of environmental toxicants affects their immune system and then makes them more vulnerable to pathogens like Lyme disease and co-infections, viruses and retroviral infections, parasitic infections, mold and fungal infections. So we look at that. And then, you know, I'm a firm believer that, you know, we are, you know, our immune systems are meant to engage with our environment, right? We're not sterile, we're more bacteria than human cells. And, you know, why are we seeing people who are really affected by these opportunistic infections? And I really think it's a combination, of course, but I think the environment plays a huge role. And we're just really in this time of environmental stress. And, you know, a young, you know, an average baby, I think they looked at this in 2005, was born with about, they did one study with the environmental working group. And I think they looked at the cord blood and found, I think, on average, 286 different chemicals. So we're not starting from zero anymore, and it's just ever increasing. And so, yeah, and then just one other note, Kevin, you know, of course, it's this physical aspect of health, but we help a lot of people, you know, land with the right resources to also look at these emotional, energetic, psycho, spiritual issues as well, because I'm a big believer that we have to address both and to really recover from any chronic health condition.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. And you brought up something there that a lot of times when people get to see you, or by the time they see you, they've seen, you know, 10, 20, 30, 54 different people. And I think that, you know, for anybody who's ever really struggled with a chronic health condition, when you're just in that place of circling around, like there's something there. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. I need to dig deeper. I think what we're going to talk about today is one of the big contributors to that. And one of the things I wanted to talk about with you was heavy metals, which we know are a contributing factor, and if not a root cause, of low energy, mood disturbances, cognitive changes, other health issues, even contributing factors to osteoporosis. So if you could, for those who aren't really familiar, could you give an idea of what are heavy metals?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's such a great subject to educate your patients, you know, because I think, again, looking at the root cause, and I may be a little biased at this point, but I think most people living on planet Earth have some exposure to heavy metals. And of course, you know, our unique genetic individuality and a whole host of other factors affects how we all deal with that stress and how our bodies bioaccumulate and handle that stress over time. But, you know, heavy metals are heavy metals. So they are things like mercury, lead, cadmium, arsenic, aluminum. They are absolutely disruptive into our human biology and human physiology, and they can be what we call neurotoxic. So I look a lot at the nervous system when I'm recovering someone's health. So we look at their brain, their central nervous system, their cranial nerves, and of course, the peripheral nervous system, because the nervous system has so much to do with the communication in our body and helping somebody recover. And so we look at heavy metals is a very common known neurotoxin. They tend to disrupt basically the nervous system by affecting the actual neuron and also affecting communication in, you know, the brain as well. And so, you know, when we look at heavy metals, it's a complicated story, Kevin, because I think we still have room to improve testing. Testing is absolutely available. But when we look at heavy metals, often if you went to a conventional doctor, they would look at heavy metals in your blood. And if you have a high amount of blood level of a heavy metal like mercury or aluminum, you're highly toxic. You've had a pretty acute exposure, a pretty significant exposure, if your body still is showing a sign of a heavy metal level in your blood. And so what the body does, it's intelligent, of course, and when exposed to heavy metal, the body tries to get that out of the blood and out of the bloodstream as fast as possible. And it can deposit in different tissues. So we see heavy metals, I already mentioned, in the nervous system. So they get you know, lodged in nerves in the brain. They can affect the heart, the gut, the connective tissue, the fascia inside the cell. And when we're testing for them, you know, we have to acknowledge that they're in different tissues and they can be released at different times. So what's kind of standard in the functional medicine or naturopathic medicine community is if we do what we call a provocation test. And so what that is we give you a chelator like DMSA, DMPS, or EDTA, and we challenge your body. So you are either given that chelator as an injectable or as an oral drug, and then we ask you to collect your urine for a period of time. And well, that's great, you know, but it has to, you know, that test result is reliant on a lot of factors, how your body handles that chelator, what your body is willing to basically excrete given the interaction of that chelator. And then, you know, if you have, you know, high heavy metal load that's in your brain, one DMPS shot or one EDTA IV is not really going to grab metals out of the brain and give us an accurate window of, you know, what your body burden is. So we have to kind of take this with a grain of salt and look at, you know, exposures, you know, not only just living on the planet, but also, you know, occupational exposures. We also are big believers in dental health and looking at, you know, our oral and dental history. Still, you know, people do have amalgams. Amalgams are a significant source of mercury that absolutely is a known neurotoxin, and absolutely people accumulate that over time and is significant. So we help people. One of the first things I do with people if they have amalgams is help them to safely remove them so we can actually get to a significant metal detox. I never want to do a strong metal detoxification. If somebody still has mercury in their mouth, they can absolutely be very aggravated and made ill if we do that too soon. And then circling back, so we have blood levels, we have this provocation test. There are hair mineral tests that, you know, can give us a window, of course. There's stool tests as well. And then again, you know, why I'm kind of painting this picture is that, you know, we have to, you know, just again, take the whole story. And if you've had a blood test and you said, oh, I've been, you know, testing to that conclusion right away, or even if you've had a provocation test and you see that maybe you're in the green or yellow zone, it's usually a green, yellow, red system. If you don't show the significant amount of body burden, don't still discount that, because it could be that you were mineral deficient, or your body was, you know, not ready to release these heavy metals, or you just weren't getting deep enough into those tissues. And so I see metal testing over time, people can have higher amounts of excretion of heavy metals as we work with them. And it's not because they're backsliding, it's actually because their body's actually getting rid of these things. So I know that's probably a long-winded answer, but I just want to paint the picture of, you know, what heavy metals are and how we can assess them today.
No, that's great. So you touched on a few different heavy metals there, mercury, arsenic, lead, cadmium. Could we go through each of those and kind of the different sources of where those might be found, how they specifically impact the body, and how each of those specifically impacts the bones?
Yeah, absolutely. So so I guess most of the research, when you look at PubMed and look at, you know, definitely, you know, what is known and studied, the two metals that often come up with, you know, osteoporosis or bone metabolism are cadmium and lead. And so let's start with lead, because this is what I often see. So lead is interesting because of the charge of lead. It's significant, or it's similar enough to calcium that we can, when exposed to lead, we actually can store lead in our bones. And so what I see, especially with women as they go through hormonal changes and their estrogen levels go down, they can start, you know, that in menopause or perimenopause, women tend to have a shift in bone metabolism and can have osteopenia, osteoporosis. And what happens is they start releasing that lead out of their bone. And so it's almost like an auto intoxication. So some women going through menopause, they can have cognitive symptoms. They can have, you know, a lot of different health symptoms come up. It can be the stored lead in their bone that's getting released. And so, of course, we look at optimizing hormones to support healthy bones and to prevent the osteoclast activity and to prevent basically bone loss. But we also want to make sure that we are giving the body significant support to get rid of that mobilized lead. And so lead is a big one. So it can be stored in the bone. We know this. And then, you know, when we look at the action of a heavy metal, it's it can be actually bone matrix metabolism and then also kidney health, right? So when we think about the role of the kidneys, with vitamin D, basically metabolism, calcium and phosphorus, basically monitoring those electrolytes and, the kidneys have a big role in our electrolyte balance and our mineral balance. And so we look at how heavy metals can affect, the kidney. They're very disruptive to the nephron. They can affect kidney filtration. And so, so lead is known to, become part of the bone matrix. So that can also weaken the bone, right? If you have lead in the place of calcium in the bone matrix, so that can create weak bones. And then when the bone starts to break down, you can release that lead. And then lead can also affect the kidneys. And then to answer your question, the sources of lead, we kind of think, oh, it's not a problem anymore because, oh, the laws around, leaded fuel, or, lead paint, we think, oh, that's past history. And, the women who are going through menopause now, they might've had a significant exposure, right? So this is a story for them, but, we still have, jet fuel still is leaded, right? And there are still, lead in surface care products and cosmetics. There is still lead in, certain, toys, from China, we're still, reminded of. So lead is still an issue. And it's definitely something that I'm always surprised and educated of how significant lead is. And lead is really important for a lot of reasons. I know we're only talking about bone health here, but, there's a window of time, especially in early development, childhood development, that even, conventional pediatricians check for lead levels in the blood because, if a child was exposed to paint or, some exposure, there's a developmental window that lead can absolutely affect IQ and cognitive ability. So it's a very problematic heavy metal that's really not only destructive to bone health, but also to our cognitive health as well. And I can go on, but I just don't want to.
That's good. That's really good. No, I'm glad you're going into detail about this. So lead is a big one. And then the other one you just mentioned was a big one that comes up for bone health.
Yeah, so cadmium. So cadmium also can be, when I was looking up, a little bit ago, I remember that, cadmium had two effects. So it can actually be cytotoxic to osteoblasts. So it can actually weaken. So there's, I'm sure you educate your community all the time. There's osteoblasts that build bone, osteoclasts that, break down bone. And it's this dynamic, every day we're doing this, to help not only build bone, but also get minerals that are needed to buffer, the body in lots of ways. And so cadmium can actually be detrimental to osteoblasts. So that's going to affect bone building. And then it also is a significant heavy metal that can actually really affect the kidneys. And it, they know that if people are cadmium toxic, that can even lead to renal failure. It absolutely can increase calcium and phosphorus excretion. So those are two minerals that are really important for bone building. And then also it can decrease vitamin D metabolism, especially via the kidney. We need vitamin D for calcium absorption and to integrate that into our bone health. And then I believe cadmium also affects the digestive tract. So we absorb nutrition in our digestive tract that we need to build healthy bone, specifically calcium. So, looking at the literature, we know cadmium and lead are very significant. And then a big metal that we are really, really sensitive to is aluminum. So aluminum is, there's a documentary called the age of aluminium, right? And it's made in Europe. That's why they call it aluminium. But we are, you know, aluminum's ubiquitous in our environment. It's in our food. It's in our water. You know, it's in the vaccines. It's in our medications. And, you know, we really have a really high total body burden of aluminum. And then with the work I do all day long, we look at the impact of aluminum primarily, of course, on a host of different body systems, but, you know, the brain. And so just to give you information again on looking at testing, there's a Professor Chris Exley. He's in Kiel, in the University of Kiel, I believe, in England. And he looked at postmortem brains in children with autism and also, you know, people who died of dementia or Alzheimer's. And he found a statistically significant amount of aluminum in the brains of not only these children, but also these deceased individuals. And why I say that is that again, you know, aluminum, again, it can be hard to test for, it can be hard to demonstrate, but, you know, when you hear somebody who, you know, dedicates their life to looking at aluminum and how it affects the body and then sees in these really advanced neurological conditions how there is aluminum that gets stored in our brain and that's where it's wreaking havoc and creating all this, we know it's an issue, right? And so with aluminum, aluminum is actually also incorporated into the bone matrix, so weakening the bone in that way. So it's absorbed, you know, via the digestive tract. There's a lot of work, you know, we're friends with Dr. Senef, and she really educated us about glyphosate. And again, you know, we're talking about heavy metals, but you can't, you know, nothing's in isolation anymore, right? There's 1 + 1 doesn't equal 2 anymore. We're in this kind of synergistic soup. And so what she's written some great papers that, you know, aluminum is actually poorly absorbed if we intake it via the digestive tract. But what we're seeing in the presence of glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, is that glyphosate creates, you know, a leaky gut primarily. So it's, you know, the intestinal lining, and it can affect, you know, our absorption and uptake of a host of different things, but aluminum. So it's like aluminum in the presence of glyphosate increases the systemic absorption where it can wreak havoc on different. And so we're getting this more, you know, more absorption through our digestion. And then of course, when you have aluminum injected in the body, it's going to bypass natural barriers that would prevent aluminum from getting into our brain and so forth. And so, so with that being said, you know, we're getting, you know, we're getting aluminum absorbed that's getting incorporated in the bone matrix. And then it's also, aluminum does have an effect on the kidney as well. So to oversimplify it, when you think about how heavy metals affect our bone health, they can have an effect on our bone matrix because of the similar charge of a heavy metal to calcium like lead. So that can get incorporated in the bone matrix and weaken the bone. They also can have a direct effect on either osteoblasts or osteoclasts and damage those cells that affect our bone metabolism. They again, not only bone, you know, the direct effect on the bones and the osteoblasts and osteoclasts, but also the kidney. So whenever I'm really supporting somebody with any detoxification protocol, especially heavy metals, it's definitely a, you know, we always take the kidneys into account because the heavy metals absolutely can damage nephrons, can affect the actual kidney filtration system. And one way to, the cool thing though, is one way to recover someone's kidneys or even support someone who has a blood pressure issue because there's a lot of blood pressure regulation in the kidney is detoxifying them from heavy metals. So that's more the mechanism that we look at.
So what are the different, that you're talking about detoxification being a really important part of, you know, if you've got heavy metal toxicity, let's first talk about what would be the preferred method of testing for heavy metals. I know you touched on urine, blood would be an option, hair I know is also an option. What are the preferred methods of testing for heavy metals?
Mm-hmm. We use urine provocation in the clinic. So we're going to use that. So we often use DMPS or EDTA and use an injection technique. Again, you know, we're working with a patient. We don't just start there, right? You know, we would want to make sure they have, you know, good kidney function, that they're doing a lot of organ support. You know, often when we do these things, when we actually even give them a chelator, even on the day of the test, we'll also support their organs of elimination with other supportive IVs like glutathione, or we'll have them do colon hydrotherapy, or we actually do foot baths, which are absolutely very helpful for kidney function and lymphatic drainage. And so we do that. And also, of course, binders are really important to support the body. And so so essentially we will do a urine provocation test. And so I typically use DMPS or EDTA, and then I do a 6-hour collection. And we not only look at the heavy metals, but we also look at the minerals. So if someone is mineral deficient and we don't see a high excretion of heavy metals, we can sometimes say they're in a metal retention pattern, because we also need minerals as cofactors for many of the enzymes to help us detoxify and to get rid of these heavy metals. So I'll use that. And then we also use a unique device in the clinic. It's called the OligoScan. It uses what we call spectrophotometry. So it's using light and principles of resonance to assess minerals and metals and the tissue, in the fascia and the connective tissue. And you know, this test actually picks up a lot of aluminum in people. So that I see more aluminum on the oligo scan, and then typically the chelators that we use aren't specific for aluminum, so that's why we don't often see aluminum in a urine provocation test. But yeah, so we, you know, we'll do, of course, the clinical history and assessment. If anyone has ever had a, you know, a mouthful of amalgams, we know that they have had a mercury exposure. But then we'll use a urine toxic metals test with doctor's data. So we work with that lab primarily, and then the oligo scan if they're in the office.
And I know Doctor's Data has an HTMA, a hair tissue mineral analysis mm-hmm. test. What's the utility of that for, mm-hmm. you know, looking at minerals and looking at heavy metals too?
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, some people do hair mineral tests all day long, and they help a lot of people. And I think it's, you know, a great tool. I don't use it that much. But again, when I have studied and learned about hair mineral tests, it can show a little bit more like acute exposure of metals that are getting excreted in the hair. It definitely picks up mineral deficiencies for sure. But again, you know, in a perfect world, Kevin, if money isn't an issue for people, I would have them do a provocation test. I would even have them do a blood test. I would have them do a hair mineral test and even a stool test to see the biliary and stool excretion of heavy metals.
What are the detox pathways that we would use for trying to excrete heavy metals?
Yeah, so I love Chris Shade's work, and he does a great job explaining a lot of the pathways that metals get excreted. And so when we think about heavy metal detoxification, we think of phase 1, 2, phase 2.5 and phase 3 detoxification. So to oversimplify this, so when we have, you know, our liver has to process so many things, right? So just normal metabolic waste, you know, normal, you know, endocrine and steroid hormone processing, cholesterol metabolism, but then it also has to process mycotoxins and heavy metals and all of the environmental toxicants that we are affected by every day. And so in normal detoxification, we have our phase 1 metabolism, and that's when we, you know, essentially act. So we, let's say we have, you know, mercury. So we're basically activating mercury, and then phase 2 is conjugation. So there's a whole host of processes that happen with conjugation. And then Kelly Halderman is a friend, and she coined the term phase 2.5. And that's a big step that I think some people get really stuck on, and it's where we take the toxicant from the hepatocyte or the liver cell, and that has to go through these transporters to reach the bile ducts and basically the gallbladder, and bile is a huge elimination route. And so phase 2.5, some people can get stuck and can't shuttle that toxicant to the bile system effectively. And so there's phase 2.5. And then phase 3 is our elimination pathway, primarily via the bile, or also there are phase 3 transporters in the kidney for elimination of heavy metals. And so we're a big proponent and not only liver detoxification and supporting people with optimizing phase one and two, and of course three, but also, you know, to oversimplify it again, you know, just getting the bile moving, right? The bile is an elimination pathway. We produce bile in the liver, it gets transported to the gallbladder, and then it gets secreted to not only digest our fats, but to eliminate all of that, all of the things I just said, you know, all the conjugation has to get eliminated through the bile. And then we eliminate our bile through our stool. And so what happens though, is like, I always think the liver did all that hard work. You know, the bile exits, helps us to digest our food. And then a lot of bile is reabsorbed through the enterohepatic recirculation. So along with that, you know, reabsorption can be this reabsorption of toxicants. And so we use binders, like any detoxification protocol or any protocol that we really use, we actually use binders. And binders are going to be things like chlorella or specific clays or specialized zeolites or charcoal even, or modified citrus pectin. And we usually have people take a binder before a meal, like 30 minutes before a meal or even away from a meal about an hour. And we want the binder to be in the digestive tract to basically bind and selectively bind to what's coming out via the bile and the intestines. So then you can eliminate that. It stays in the digestive tract and you can eliminate that through the stool rather than being reabsorbed. So those are kind of the big mechanics that I think about when we think about how metals are excreted. Of course, there's a excretion phase in the kidney, but we want to protect the kidneys. You know, the liver can regenerate very well and repair very well, but the kidneys are more vulnerable. And, you know, we want to protect the kidneys and shuttle a lot of our detoxification strategies via the gut and the stool rather than via the kidney.
So I know if you know, you're somebody who has gut health issues or something like that, that can actually put more pressure and burden on the kidneys, right?
So so one of the things that Dr. Shade also talks about is his word for phase 2.5 is intrahepatic cholestasis. And so this like impediment of bile flow from the intestines or into the intestines and the exit route via the stool. And what can impair that is inflammation, especially endotoxin or lipopolysaccharide. That's basically being produced in the gut. And so to your point, if the gut is inflamed, if there's a lot of dysbiosis, then that can tell and signal the liver to not shuttle toxicants out through the bile, and then they get shuttled out back into the bloodstream and to the kidney, and puts more burden on the kidney to remove those toxicants.
Yeah, and then so if we have heavy metal toxicity and we're trying to do a controlled detoxification protocol, are there certain foods and supplements and things like that that we want to make sure that we're avoiding, so we're not improperly chelating and causing some other health issues?
Yeah, you know, I would always, you know, I'm a big proponent, of course, I want to empower people and have people, you know, do things on their own and, you know, not have to go through a gatekeeper to get their health. You know, I want that. But when it comes to heavy metal detoxification, I think it's a great use of resources to work with a provider that does this all day long, just to support you as best as possible. But when we think about, you know, detoxification, we want to always, you know, try to limit and avoid exposure before starting a detoxification, you know, protocol. One of the biggest missteps I think I see is that people actively try to detoxify when they still have a significant exposure, or they have, you know, mercury amalgam still in their mouth. And so, you know, I know it's hard to just tell everyone to go get their mercury amalgams removed, but it's one of the things that is absolutely important and really essential to take the next step to significantly reduce the body burden of heavy metals. So yeah, I think that, you know, when you think about what to avoid and what not to do, you know, don't try to really aggressively detoxify when you have a known exposure. And then I think that we always have to think about, before we even layer on, you know, a significant protocol, is how do we open up the routes of elimination? So as a naturopath, I'm always thinking about my patients' routes of elimination. So, you know, liver and bile and you know, are they having regular bowel movements, kidney function and hydration, you know, lung health, skin health, and, you know, the lymphatic system as well. The lymphatic system is, I think, one of the most overlooked systems in the body. And I think it's essential, you know, for detoxification and really to recover someone's health. We do a lot of lymphatic drainage work. And so, you think about laying the foundation, you know, for, you know, proper elimination. So when you start asking the body to push out deeper stored toxicants, they have a route to go, right? And so we look at that. And then every protocol that we have, we use binders, you know, so we use binders to help support whatever we're going to layer on top of to help proper elimination and create safety in a protocol. And then we also ask, you know, our patients are highly motivated. They don't feel well. They, you know, they absolutely are up for doing lifestyle tools and techniques. So we have often they'll do castor oil packs or even coffee enemas at home or dry skin brushing. So that all lays the foundation to when you want to add in things such as cilantro tincture or high doses of melatonin or DMSA or EDTA or DMPS even, or you know, other detoxification strategies. But my word of caution is don't just, you know, dive in, you know, first look and see, do you have a significant exposure currently in your body or in your environment? And then also just really support all of your organs of elimination. We absolutely want to make sure that we lay the groundwork and clear the path before we ask the body to really eliminate these toxic metals or even other environmental pollutants, that there's a clear path out. So we're not recirculating or creating aggravations in the system.
No, that, I think that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, you mentioned some different tools that people can be using or that are used in detoxification, but I think it's really important not to troubleshoot this on your own. And before you go try to do anything else, you mentioned if you've got mercury amalgams, those need to come out. If you're going to do that, I would definitely go see like a holistic dentist that is trained in a mercury safe protocol. And then after you do something like that, then it would probably be good to see someone like Christine or, you know, another naturopathic physician, something like that, to actually get a plan in place to do this, because you don't want to be troubleshooting these things on your own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think it's a great point. And, you know, getting someone's amalgams removed can be, you know, one of the best things that they can, you know, do for their health. And I hate, you know, to hear those stories where people got worse or they got aggravated from that. And so really working with a biological dentist, there's an organization, IAOMT.org, and you can find a biological dentist in your neighborhood. And then also, of course, not only working with a dentist, but working with a naturopathic doctor or a functional medicine provider where you can do IV therapy or chelation or lymph drainage or colon hydrotherapy or, you know, these comprehensive protocols to really support your system.
So obviously it depends on, you know, how toxic you are, but how long does it take to get metals out of your body?
It's a great question. And, you know, I've been only doing this for 10 years, but I'm always humbled with how much of a process heavy metal detoxification is. Not to discourage anyone, because of course people feel better, you know, when they start doing this, but I think it's this really dynamic process where, you know, you get layers, you know, you get to different layers at different times. So, you know, you get rolling and get a significant, you know, body burden reduced in the body. And then over time, as your body is healthier and, you know, your minerals, you know, go up and you kind of really clear the pathway systemically, then you can get deeper into the system. And then, you know, it takes time. And I honestly think though, Kevin, you know, there's this catch up, right? If you have a chronic illness, of course, there's this recovery time. But heavy metal detoxification is also a lifestyle. I feel like, you know, we're constantly being exposed, right? So it's something that you want to have lifestyle practices and really even make, you know, a detoxification like a heavy metal detoxification, maybe even a few times a year, doing a circuit or a protocol to support your body and just keep that body burden low.
What are some of the daily, I think you touched on a few of them, like dry brushing. What are some of the daily practices that people can be applying in their lives to actually maintain a detoxified body?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, you know, you want to avoid exposure. So always, you know, think of filtration of your water. So I always recommend a good water filter. You want to get the aluminum and the fluoride out of the water as well as other heavy metals. And then, you know, of course, clean food and trying to have, you know, clean air as much as possible. You know, if you live close to a highway, having an air filter in your home and so forth. And then, you know, lifestyle techniques, of course, sweating, right? So sweating is very well documented that it is absolutely a excretion route for environmental toxicants such as heavy metals. There have been studies in Finland to show a decrease in risk of cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's with patients who sauna, I think, about four times a week. It's more of a sauna culture, but there are saunas are more affordable and more accessible than they have been. And so sauna therapy or just getting a good sweat, you know, is important. Other lifestyle techniques, some of my patients have a home foot bath, and a foot bath is actually a device. It's using biophysics, and that you put your feet in water with salt, and then it has an array that puts an electrical current where you basically absorb different electrons, and that actually helps your body to detoxify like a few days later. So we've done studies and shown that day three after a foot bath is when you increase your urinary excretion of heavy metals. So they've actually shown that. And there's a great foot bath company called A Major Difference, and they work with a lot of children with autism, and they've shown reduction in heavy metal testing with regular foot baths. So foot baths do work. We were skeptical, but they do, and it's a great tool. It's safe and gentle.
What kind of salt is using that?
Just a good high quality salt. So usually we use a Celtic sea salt or a Himalayan salt. So that's what we've been using. So,
and does that mimic, you know, the electrical current or something like that? Does that mimic grounding that you would experience like outside? Sure.
It's a good question. I think it's a little bit more intensified than grounding, but, you know, grounding is putting your bare feet in contact with the earth to absorb electrons from the earth. And it absolutely has a, you know, really positive balancing effect on the body. And there's research to show that not only do people feel calmer and more, you know, less anxious and more grounded per se, but it shows that it can decrease inflammation and improve blood coagulation markers. So when people tend to be sick or chronically ill, they have more thick or sticky blood. And so that can, you know, affect their delivery of oxygen and nutrition to their tissues. And so grounding is a great way to improve that. So it's similar, but different.
Well, so the one of the last things I wanted to talk to you about was Lyme disease. I know you've built mm-hmm. partnerships and working relationships with practitioners all over the world, and you're really well respected in that field. And I know patients who have either had or currently have Lyme disease actually experience an increased likelihood of developing osteopenia or osteoporosis. Could you talk a little bit about, for people who aren't even familiar with it, what Lyme disease is?
Yeah, you know, so Lyme disease is, you know, it's a broad term now, right? And so when I say Lyme disease, I'm not only referring to Lyme or Borrelia burgdorferi, spirochetal infection, but I'm also referring to co-infections that are often co-transmitted with Lyme. So that can be Babesia, Bartonella, Rickettsia, Ehrlichia, Mycoplasma, Chlamydia pneumoniae, these type of bacterial infections. And so what we see with Lyme disease is that it definitely is an epidemic in our country. It's not just isolated to the Northeast or, you know, to Lyme, Connecticut, but we see Lyme in all 50 states. It's not only transmitted through a tick, but it's also a vector-borne illness where it can be transmitted from mosquitoes, you know, even fleas. There is discussion of maternal fetal transfer of Lyme in the womb, as well as has sexual transmission of Lyme disease as well. And so, you know, it's something I think a lot of people honestly have had an exposure. Again, you know, where I stand is like, oh, okay, just because you've had an exposure, not everybody gets sick. Of course, there are those significant acute exposures that people get sick. But what I see, what I tend to see is that someone may have had an exposure, their immune system might have, you know, again, handled it, or it wasn't as significant. And then because of life, maybe they lived in a moldy home of black mold, or they had a significant trauma or, you know, stress in their life, or, you know, essentially they are, you know, or they had a vaccine reaction or whatever. And then there's this accumulation of stress where their immune system, you know, can't handle it anymore. And, you know, they become very symptomatic, and these pathogens, you know, wreak havoc in their system. So, you know, Lyme can, you know, traditional, the Borrelia, you know, it affects the connective tissue and affects joints. So people can have migrating arthralgias or migrating joint pain. It also can affect, Borrelia can also affect the vagus nerve. It can also affect the heart muscle. So there's Lyme carditis, and it can affect heart function. Lyme can also affect the brain, and can be a huge trigger for neurological diseases such as, you know, MS and Parkinson's and ALS. And then Babesia is a red blood cell. It's a protozoal infection that affects the red blood cell, and it can affect, you know, if somebody has anemia, chronic anemia, you know, if they have, you know, migraines, anxiety, air hunger, constipation. That's kind of a picture of Babesia. Bartonella is also called cat scratch disease, and Bartonella is a very neurological presentation. So many neurological, you know, presentations, especially I see a lot of young women with, you know, POTS, which is postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, where their, you know, autonomic nervous system is not regulating well. So Bartonella can be part of that. And then, yeah, so as you see, there's these multi-systemic infections, and, you know, really the, and then there's can be a psychological presentation to Lyme. So there can be depression, anxiety, OCD, you know, insomnia as well. And so when you think about this, you know, you can, you know, many people have these symptoms. And, you know, when I talk about Lyme, I think it's really important to just understand, you know, it going back that there's always a root cause, right? So if you have a label of a neurological condition, or a label of an autoimmune condition, or a label of really any chronic condition, you know, really, you know, take a look and look at, you know, what pathogens could be driving these immune over or under reactions, as well as your toxic burden, your toxic load. And of course, again, the psychological aspect or the mental emotional aspect as well. But it can feel very overwhelming when you think about all of this. But I want it to be an empowering perspective in that, you know, essentially, you know, once you address and identify these things, and this is another thing where lab tests can absolutely fail us, and it has to be a clinical presentation as well. You know, but once you treat these things, you know, it does take time. It is a process, but people do get their life back.
Because Lyme is one of those, you know, diseases that people could, it may be one of the last things that people find out is contributing to their health issues, right? Rarely is that the first thing that comes to mind when someone is really struggling or suffering. How do you end up determining that someone has Lyme disease?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Lyme is a clinical diagnosis, but there are lab tests out there. And so the gold standard is something called a Western blot, where we look at antibody presence to the infection. So we'll look at IgG or IgM antibodies to see about the immune system exposure. There's also PCR, looking at DNA and seeing if there's the presence of the bugs. You know, with Lyme, the hard part is if you just look in the blood, you will miss the presence of the DNA, because Lyme doesn't live in the blood, nor do, you know, many of the co-infections. They live in the, you know, deeper in the tissues. And so we developed kind of this provocation test with a company called DNA Connections, where we essentially had people do a deep type of body work where we're stressing their connective tissue, and then we're basically moving the microbes from the connective tissue into the lymphatics and into the kidney, where we collect the urine. And we found many, many patients become positive when we did that provocation test with, you know, demonstrating that they did have Lyme and co-infections. And then there's another test called the AliSpot LTT test, and it's a lymphocyte test, and it's looking at how reactive are lymphocytes, which is an immune cell that fights, you know, infection, how reactive it is to the presence of one of those bugs. So again, in a perfect world, I do all of those testing tests. And then, you know, it's a clinical diagnosis. I'm very confident in looking at, you know, labs, plus clinical history, and you know, having enough information to start doing a clinical trial of botanicals, herbs, supplements, and even medications to, you know, treat these infections, and you know, in the hopes that people will get better by treating these things.
That's amazing, and helping people just get their lives back, because I know that that can really take a toll on their lives.
You know, my goal always is that, you know, I see, again, patients who have seen so many people, and I would love to make sure that people get diagnosed and on the right treatment more quickly, because if you can catch these things and address these things sooner rather than later, it is definitely, it's absolutely easier to turn around. And, you know, I just see so many people's lives, you know, wrecked, you know, and taken out of life and struggling for way too long, without a proper diagnosis and effective treatment.
So I think that's a good transition to, how can people find you and your work?
Oh, well, thank you. So I have a website, drchristineschaffner.com. I have a podcast you mentioned, and, you know, I see patients. So yeah, just check me out there, and I'm happy to help in any way.
And I'll be sure to link to that in the show notes too, so people can access that.
Thank you.
Dr. Schaffner, thank you so much. I appreciate your time, and I'm glad you came on the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Kevin, for having me.
Thanks. Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of The Bone Coach Show. Hope you enjoyed it. If you found it helpful, go ahead and punch that like button, comment below, let me know what you learned. And if you think somebody else could benefit from it, go ahead and share it with them. Last thing I'll say is, again, if you haven't done so already, head over to bonecoach.com. There's a link below. You can sign up for your free 7-day osteoporosis kickstart guide and start taking charge of your bone health right now. I'll see you in the next episode.